Coming up in today's My Ag Life Daily News Report, Taylor's here with an interview on hemp. That's coming up later in the show. We start today with information for the walnut industry.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board.
Rabobank came out with a five-year price forecast for walnuts. To get details, I talked with David Magana, Senior Fresh Produce and Tree Nut Analyst with Rabobank. Here's our conversation.
So we have the five-year walnut market outlook that Rabobank put a lot of effort and research into. And I wanted to talk with you about some of the things that were in the outlook. But before we get into what's in there, can you tell me a little bit about what went into putting this together? What kind of research or how much research did this take?
Well, it certainly involves a lot of work in collecting the statistics for the industry and in also in building an analytical tool to be able to estimate what shipments, prices, production may look like 5 years out.
So what were some of the interesting things that you found? If you were to, as it says here in the paper, in a nutshell, what were some of the things that were discovered?
Yeah, to start, general market trends, we see increasing global competition for walnuts, particularly coming from Chile and China. And probably the most surprising is China, which is rapidly capturing market share in the export market. However, the U.S. Continues to be the main exporter of walnuts, and Europe continues to be the main market destination for this product.
And most of U.S. walnuts are exported. Our export market is extremely important. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Over the last few years, around 70% of the domestic production gets exported. So, the industry relies heavily on this export market. And currently, some of the challenges are this increasing international competition and also the trade war specifically some tariffs going into some Asian markets.
Right. And I wanted to ask you about that, not the tariffs, but about China and about their market growing. And how will that affect U.S. exports with China's walnut market growing?
Yeah, like China has been the main producer of walnuts. But what has been surprising over the last couple of years is that they are now exporting, and their presence in the export market is increasing. It's just tied in second place with Chile, which has been in the space a little bit longer than China, and now putting some additional pressure into this in this market.
And, you know, and like we were talking about before I started recording, I'm wondering, with China growing its export market, and like you said, they are the top producer for walnuts, with them growing their export markets coupled with, as you mentioned, the tariffs and other trade issues with Asian markets, is that going to hurt us going into larger Asian markets?
Well, I will try to answer that on the way we were estimating what shipments may look like. We were kind of analyzing the main export markets for U.S. walnuts, and to estimate what these shipments may be for the next 5 years, we took a statistical approach to relate some of the drivers in these markets that are impacting their demand for U.S. walnuts, particularly, obviously, income, prices, tariffs. And once we have all this demand side for U.S. walnuts in the export market, we also do the same for the U.S. market, including, for example, GDP per capita, some of that drivers that can explain how we may be looking at shipments to the domestic market as well. And in general, obviously, these tariffs are not been helping. And also, this international competition is putting pressure also on prices.
Let's talk a little bit about bumper crops. I saw bumper crops mentioned in the report as well. What kind of an effect are we, are there more bumper crops coming, or are we expecting more? And what kind of an effect is that going to continue to have?
Yeah. The other side of our analytical tool, besides the demand side, obviously, is the production side. To estimate future production, we took into consideration the plantings over the last few years. Obviously, the production that will be hitting the market in the next 5 years will be coming from trees that are already in the ground. So we take acreage, also age of trees, and we have this range of yields that are a function mainly of weather factors, but we cannot predict weather, but we are taking into consideration this potential variability in yields. So taking all that together, we are estimating that the production for the next 5 years is more likely to be higher than the production that we saw in 2019. And probably we could see another record crop in any of these years. However, we, on average, we expect that the annual production could be somewhere between the production in 2019 and the production in 2020. So more bumper crops are likely to hit the market in the next few years.
And what about demand? Are we seeing demand increasing? I know 2020 is, kind of a hard year to really judge anything because everything was so different. But what's the trend in walnut demand?
Well, it's been certainly during these COVID times, one aspect has been increased retail sales and increased at-home cooking, and that's been helping the demand for walnuts in general in the U.S. and also in some export markets. And now, there have been some research that has been out focusing on the nutritional aspects of walnuts and how some consumers, particularly those that are focusing on plant-based diets and want to eat a more healthy diet, those aspects will be driving the demand for walnuts. However, there is also increasing competition in the tree nut space with also record crops of almonds, pistachios, and that is for sure competing for the budget, the consumer budget, in the tree nut space.
What would you say would be the key takeaways from the report?
Well, obviously, there are some challenges from the supply side. Growers will continue to face increasing environmental and water regulations, which contribute to increasing production costs. So a challenge of continuing high-quality walnut production under more efficient systems will remain something imperative. But the industry has shown that it's possible to do that. I mean, they've been innovating and they've been pretty resilient. But nevertheless, I think boosting demand in the domestic and export markets for the growing U.S. output is yet another formidable challenge as we see it. Walnuts have a high protein content, as well as elevated level of healthy fatty acids. And I think it has the potential. I think consumers need to be more familiar with walnuts, the benefits, and different ways that they can consume walnuts. Also for the food service industry, probably there is an opportunity to increase the amount of walnuts in different products, taking advantage of these plant-based trends in general. And that has to be more promotion research needs to be done, so the industry can achieve better prices. Because one other thing that we didn't cover yet in this is from our report, once we have the supply and demand parts of the model, then we are estimating prices, obviously with some probabilistic range. And overall, prices tend to be not the best, and our estimates for the next 5 years will be kind of borderline around the production cost for some growers. But something that is still imperative is how to boost this demand to improve prices, given that more production is likely to come at higher at high levels, or at least higher than it historically has been.
And that is something else that was in the report. Excuse me. That's something else that was in the report that I wanted to ask you about as well. In the report, it does say that downside price risk may linger. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. So this, again, given this supply and demand interaction, we're estimating prices for, to the grower, and prices obviously are under pressure during this 2020-21 marketing season. We're expecting prices to improve a little bit during 2021 and all the way until 2025. However, they could be, our average estimate is still below $1, probably even like could be around 80 cents, our average estimate. And if we have a combination of higher demand, and probably if there is some disruption in production, we could see some higher prices, and depending also on the inventory levels and what's going on. So we're estimating that with about 25% probability, we could see prices over $1 for the next few years. However, on the negative side, if we continue to see bumper crops, and the demand continues to be flat, probably that will be impacting our price outlook, as we also are providing some probabilities for lower prices than our average estimates.
We have a link to contact information for David in the show notes if you'd like more information on.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board. Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Here's today's news brief. The Rebuild Rural Coalition calls President Joe Biden's infrastructure plan a good starting point for discussions with Congress. In a January letter, the coalition outlined the needs of rural America while highlighting U.S. agriculture's ability to produce and efficiently transport products across the globe. The coalition is comprised of national agriculture and rural business groups, state farm bureaus, and commodity organizations, among others. How is federal crop insurance policy factoring in both changing climate conditions and climate-smart farming practices? Rod Bain looks into it.
With increasing talk lately about climate-smart agriculture and climate in general, there have also been questions from producers how this may impact crop insurance. Thomas Wirth, USDA's Risk Management Agency Chief Actuary, has received many of these questions, some of which he answered at the recent AgriPulse Ag and Food Summit, including
crop insurance loss experience over time. How is climate change impacting risk, or how are crop insurance rates accounting for that risk?
The answer is complex, with no one factor driving crop insurance losses, according to Wirth. While he feels climate change is increasing risk,
at the same time, farmers are not sitting still. There's improvements in agronomics and ag technology that's decreasing risk.
There has also been improvements in risk reduction through how the crop insurance program has been administered over time.
Improvements have been made to the policy terms and language, or improvements in the accuracy of how coverage is established for farmers, or compliance enforcement, or data mining to help RMA better focus resources.
Yet with the dynamics in play determining current crop insurance premiums, Wirth says that has resulted in RMA moving from its 45-year historic average to understand climate and weather through that period.
Instead of a longer time frame, we've moved to a rolling 20-year average. This allows premium rates to respond more quickly to changes in risk and better reflect evolving conditions. This approach has resulted in good actuarial performance, which is our overall goal here.
Another question asked of Wirth and others in the crop insurance industry, does insurance recognize risk reduction from conservation practices?
To the extent that a farmer adapts their practices to reduce risk, such as planting cover crops, they get better insurance coverage at a lower premium rate. In other words, we have what I would call a results-based discount for conservation or other practices. To the extent that these practices improve a yield, especially by reducing losses in bad years.
There is also the general question of how is crop insurance adapting to changing climate? Examples include,
we do periodic reviews of weather and climate data with respect to sort of key program dates, for example, the early planting date. We're always looking at and making refinements to mapping out high-risk land like floodplains and so forth. Do those need to be revised in light of data or developments?
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Corn and biofuels groups made their arguments Tuesday in a court case for year-round E15. Growth Energy, the Renewable Fuels Association, and the National Corn Growers gave oral arguments in the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers versus EPA to the D.C. Circuit Court. Oil refiners are challenging the Environmental Protection Agency's 2019 rulemaking that paved the way for the year-round sale of E15. What are highlights of USDA's latest monthly crop reports? Stephanie Ho has the report.
April is usually a fairly quiet month for USDA's crop production report.
But I think there were some bits and pieces of quite interesting information.
That was chief economist Seth Meyer, who first pointed to the nation's citrus production.
We see some of the initial implications of that short but intense freeze we had a few weeks back on some of the Texas citrus production numbers.
The Texas all-orange forecast is down 30% from the previous forecast, while in Florida, the forecast is down 7%.
We had a really large increase in the drop. There's this loss of production that comes from dropped fruit. And we saw that have an effect, and that I think was a Florida effect, and that tends to be a lagging effect from drought.
The nation's overall all-orange forecast for the 2021 season is 4.45 million tons, down 4% from the March forecast. Meanwhile, he adds that USDA's latest world agricultural supply and demand estimates reflect information from other recently released reports, including the March grain stocks report.
When we look at the corn balance sheet, you know, we had a rise in feed use out of the grain stocks report. We had a rise in ethanol of assumed corn going into ethanol, and then a rise in exports as well, too. And those are all things which then push us into a tighter position for carryout stocks for corn.
He also points to what he sees as the biggest news for soybeans.
We saw them increase the size of the Brazilian crop. It isn't a lot. It's about 80 million bushels worth of additional production.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekanowski has more details.
They've had favorable conditions when you look over the course of the entire growing season. And as a result, we increased our Brazil soybean production estimates. So now we're looking at a record crop there, record area, record yield, and record production.
In another part of the world, he says too much rain may affect Australia's cotton crop.
For several years now, Australia has been suffering extreme drought, but this year things really turned around. They had a good growing season, timely rains to support a good cotton crop. But now, just as harvest is getting underway, they got hit with really excessive rainy conditions, and we think that is probably going to dent their yields a little bit.
Meanwhile, he also noted price increases for cattle and hogs.
Reflecting just strong meat demand, strong cash prices, and real recovery in demand there if you think back from where we were a year ago at the start of the pandemic.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
U.S. farm tractor unit sales extended their growth streak to 11 straight months. Canada also extended its own streak with a strong month of March, according to the latest data from the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. U.S. total farm tractor sales rose 84.1% in March compared to 2020. Meanwhile, U.S. combine sales grew 6.7%. That's your news brief for today. Taylor Chalstom is up next to talk about hemp. We'll be right back.
My Ag Life and Citrus is brought to you by Soil and Crop Incorporated, your number one resource for sustainable crop nutrition by putting nature to work for you.
Today, we're talking with James Knox, owner of KLR Farms, about the fundamentals of hemp nutrition and how growers can meet nutrient needs for this crop. Welcome, James.
Hey, thanks for having me, you guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good to have you here. James, here's my first question for you. A hemp plant requires different nutrients throughout its various growth stages, just as other annuals do. What nutrients are critical for hemp growth, and when should those be applied?
So first and foremost, we lead in most situations with crop production and crop nutrition based on whether it's an annual or perennial. The hemp plant is an annual plant, so we know that this plant is giving all that it's got in one season, not multiple seasons. So nutrition typically for fast-growing annuals like the hemp plant is going to be accelerated and a little more aggressive than a lot of farmers typically may be used to, depending on the crop types they're already cultivating. Fertilizer or nutrient packages for fast-growing annuals, in particular hemp, which is probably one of the most voracious growing annual plants on the planet. It is a nitrogen hog. It can eat a lot of nitrogen. So we're going to speak to the macro elements, right? The NPK and actually the S as well. A lot of people don't realize that sulfur is a macro and it's actually an NPKS. But nitrogens, a lot of people that are doing field crop with hemp emulate the corn crop when it comes to nitrogen needs and the phosphorus and potassium needs, as the corn itself obviously throws out a large fruiting body, the corn cob itself. So you have a lot of similarities between the two crops there as far as nutritional needs. So accelerated nitrogen, in particular through adolescence and transition in particular, a lot of farmers have a tendency to drop nitrogen off too early. In the crop production cycle, where there's the transition from adolescence into the reproductive cycle or the transitioning, right? Not realizing that the plant isn't just going to subsist off of just phosphorus and potassium, but also needs a healthy dose of nitrogen almost all the way halfway through a flowering cycle. Then, of course, you bring on your phosphorus macro element during the heaviest part of the flowering cycle, which is typically between week 3 and 6 of flowering. And you bring on the potassium gradually throughout flowering and make sure that it's present in a necessary volume or an aggressive or accelerated volume by week 5 of flowering, and finish out with that, as that's the bulking and ripening agent. A lot of people ask me, what kind of nutrition does the plant need when it's an infantile plant or a seedling? As most people know that utilize seeds for production, or start with a seed, not necessarily a clone. Seeds, whether they're a monocot or a dicot, come prepackaged with all the nutrients they need to get out of the seed coat itself and come out, sprout, and then start to develop into a multi-leafed organism. Typically by the second or third set of true leaves is when I start to recommend people start to fertilize their seedlings. Foliar spray or adjuvants or biostimulants like kelp or maybe some hydrolyzed cold processed fish are good foliar sprays for young infantile plants, even at first true leaf. But we want to be careful not to fertilize too much when they're young, as we don't want them to lodge and get leggy either. In particular, be careful with your nitrogen at a young infantile stage.
I'm curious. So obviously hemp is grown indoors and outdoors, and outdoors, there's going to be some variability in the growing mediums, use the types of soil. How have you found that some of the nutrients applied may differ throughout the season depending on the soil type for hemp? Have you seen any differences there?
Yes, the answer is yes to that, because soil temperature has everything to do with the way the fertilizer or the elements move into the plant. Nitrogen, for example, is a plant nutrient that can move into the root tissue and into the plant and be utilized at the plant at a very low temperature. Okay, phosphorus and potassium, not so much, phosphorus in particular. And so soil temperatures have a lot to do with how you're going to fertigate throughout the season in a native field environment. When the soil temps get to a static 50 to 55 degrees, or more importantly, when do they stop doing that at end of summer going into fall? So farmers need to be in tune with their soil type and their soil temps, as in when is it warm enough to plant and when does it become too cold, where the plant basically goes dormant and looks to terminate come end of fall. That window between those two is the window of opportunity you have to feed and nourish the plant and not be wasting money on fertilizer that's not necessarily going to move into the plant. Now, in retrospect, indoors is an indoor environment. In particular, you're in control of the environment. Therefore, you have a static control of the temperature. Is there fluctuations between when the lights are on or off or when it's daytime, nighttime? Of course. But in most applications, most greenhouse growers, most indoor growers are never going to let the temperature or the ambient room temperature drop below 55. 55 degrees is the magic number for all the elements to move into the plant via fertilizer, and when the biology wakes up and starts to do what it's supposed to do in the soil horizon as well.
Okay, great. Thanks for that, James. My next question for you here. In a recent article you were featured in for Organic Farmer magazine, you mentioned that organic biostimulants and enzymes also assist hemp growth. How did those work?
So we can define organic biostimulants in layman's terms would be like kelp, right? Kelp has a lot of cytokinins, gibberellins, auxins, a lot of plant growth hormones, naturally occurring plant growth hormones. There are other products out there that can give you a systemic and a SAR response even from the plant itself. SAR response being an immune response, right? Whether it be from eustress or distress. Either way, you can crop steer and manipulate the plant in the way that it grows or its growth habit or its rate of growth with these biostimulants. Biostimulants could also be classified as a compost tea, where you have a healthy array and spectrum of microorganisms, your protozoas, your amoebas, your facultative anaerobes, bacteria, fungi, et cetera, right? Trichodermas. All of those things do have a reaction with the plant, because when those microorganisms colonize around the stomata of the plant, it creates a greater respiratory action from the plant. Therefore, there's more exchange. that's an amplified increase in plant performance just on its own. Obviously, we also know those biostimulants and bacterial teas, fungal dominant teas, are also going to be antagonists to pathogens, which are obviously bad for a plant. We also talk about enzymes, right? Enzymes are there to produce. I view enzymes in particular myself as a way to, at the root zone, keep the root tissue very healthy by making sure that there's enzymes present to continue to break down things in the soil for the microorganisms then to then metabolize and turn back over to the plants in a nutrient form that they can pick up. A byproduct of bacteria expressing themselves in the soil is the secretion of enzymes. So a good healthy microorganism balance in the soil allows that plant to express its best genetics potential because it has a healthy root system that's always working at its optimum level.
Okay. I want to go back to those biostimulants for a second. Biostimulants are, how you'd say, a notoriously confusing type of product in agriculture. I wonder, do you see a lot of people in the hemp industry adopting the use of biostimulants?
It depends on the type of farmer and honestly their scope, scale, and or even the way that they're tooled. To foliar apply on a large scale requires some pretty big equipment. In certain types of equipment, as you roll over the crop or as you move through the crop in the dead rows. Diesel and the economic thresholds associated with diesel and labor and time and wear on the machine will reflect whether people choose to use it as a foliar application situation or if they drip it in through fertigation or irrigation or just spray it overhead. What I see happening more often than not in the hemp industry currently is the use of biostimulants or enzymes or bacteria or microorganism-based products to either amplify nutrition, upload or chelation in the soil, or to manage or mitigate pathogens and insects from above the ground.
Taylor will be right back after this message from our sponsor.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
James, you mentioned those compost tea applications. In that same Organic Farmer article, actually, you talk about the use of compost tea applications, noting that bacterial dominant teas are more beneficial to hemp plants than fungal dominant ones. Can you explain the difference and the advantages of those bacterial teas for hemp plants?
I can. So we're again speaking to an annual plant, not a perennial. Your fungi is an organism that will stand the test of time. I mean, there's fungal networks on this planet that are as old as the planet itself, right? And so fungi is for the long term, the long haul, much more beneficial and symbiotic with your perennial plants, your trees, your multi-year, multi-decade, multi-century living, flora. Bacteria is there as the front lines, the ones that do the most battle, the most work. They're the ones that are expendable. I usually consider my bacteria my expendable army that I'm sending off to do their job, knowing they're not coming back, kind of a thing. Bacteria are there to break down the inorganic and organic substances in the soil, metabolize them in a way that the plant can pick them back up and utilize them as a plant nutrient. They're also there to detoxify the soil, as a lot of bacteria have been found to deal with a lot of toxic agents, heavy metals, oils, even from fossil fuel waste. And bacteria are probably one of the most amazing and powerful organisms on this planet based on all the things that they can do and do. Bacteria is our leverage because it's the fast one. It's the fast cycling one. I tell people when they're building their compost tea, for example, a lot of people will use kelp, which is a good it's a proper carbohydrate because it's a complex carbohydrate. So is a fish. But then there's the folks that love to use a molasses. Well, molasses is a simple carbohydrate, and that's going to be used up very quickly by the bacteria and those microorganisms. It's almost like the candy bar version, opposed to, say, kelp or fish, which is more like the steak and potatoes version. You get a much better expression from a complex carbohydrate food source presented to the microorganisms, which then allow the bacteria to exponentiate in the soil and work better in the soil, therefore turning over more nutrients in the soil. Therefore, we have a better genetic potential.
As you just said, those bacterial dominant teas are going to be more beneficial. Do the fungal dominant ones really have any place then, or do they just have other applications separate from what you're talking about?
They do have their place because fungi are also decomposers. And in most cases, a lot of people now, which is great, are familiar with the term mycorrhizae, right? So everybody, like, mycorrhizae is this new big thing. Well, it's been here since the beginning of time, and it'll be here long after the end of time. The mycorrhizal fungi, there's three different kinds. There's endomycorrhizae, there's ectomycorrhizae, and then there's a third kind called ericoid mycorrhizae, which is for ericaceous plants. A lot of people aren't even aware that there's a third that exists. Your ectomycorrhizae fungi is for your needle-bearing trees and typically your perennials, where your endomycorrhizae assimilate and work with your fast-growing annuals. All of this fungi is desirable to plant performance because they still help mineralize and mine phosphorus, which is obviously good for fruiting and flowering. They also help the plant be more drought resistant. So and also deal with other pathogens potentially in the soil by pushing them out or over dominating them. So is fungi still a necessary component to the tea? Yes. Fungal dominant, not so much, but always a necessary component, always.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification on that.
Yeah.
We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
This podcast is sponsored by the California Walnut Board.
Hi, we're back talking with James Knox, owner of KLR Farms, about the fundamentals of hemp nutrition and how growers can meet nutrient needs for this crop. James, my next question for you here, what is the difference in nutrient management? And you talked about this a little earlier, for indoor and outdoor hemp plants throughout the season.
So outdoors, you're typically committing to a 4 to sometimes 6 plus month process when you're dealing with the hemp plant, where indoors you are controlling the environment, which also includes controlling the lights or the photo period. Most hemp plants are not day neutral. They're actually plants that require an interruption of photo period to induce flowering or the depreciation of light hour during the days. Because you're indoors, you can trigger those plants into a flowering or a reproductive stage at near any point in growth. Therefore, you can shorten the growth cycle. Therefore, you're shortening the volume or depreciating the volume of everything you need to execute. Outdoors, you're obviously going to see just quite the opposite, where you're in it for the long haul. In most cases, there's no way to manipulate the light cycle, especially when we're talking about vast expanses of acres. And so your differences are going to be the investment of time and the reflection of what that means as far as the volume of product you're going to need to execute. What a lot of farmers forget is that on the full term, full sun situation, is that you're dealing with an organism that is continually getting bigger, bigger, and bigger. And so indoors, where things can get to a fixed point and there's a very homogeneous footprint of adolescent to smaller bodied plants compared to massive plants potentially out in the field, they also need to be able to adjust to know that those plants are going to need to eat 2 to 3 times as much as far as a fertilizer need goes compared to when they were either adolescents, infantiles, or an indoor situation.
Okay.
Budget. Budget is key.
Yeah, no, it sounds like there's, like you said, there's going to be a monetary difference for sure between nutrient managing the indoor and the outdoor. You know, why wouldn't a grower just go for the cheap option overall for that?
It depends on the ideology. It also depends on their skill set. Your indoor cultivated product is typically could be classified as boutique, as long as the farmer itself knows what they're doing, right? Anyone can succeed or fail, whether it's indoor, greenhouse, or field. And so, I mean, the onus is on the farmer to provide the plant everything it needs. If in fact the farmer is able to do so, then you should be expecting the best representation of genetic expression from the plant. The other caveat to indoor gardening is sometimes, because it is such a boutique potential or top shelf high-end potential, that the fertilizer product itself is of a higher denomination value for purchase because they're using a higher end nutrient or not necessarily an agricultural grade volume based nutrient.
So is there some sort of premium associated with indoor production versus outdoor?
There can be. The hemp market is still maturing on all levels, from all product lines and SKUs, from seeds all the way to the shelf. So you have farmers that are willing to put a lot more effort and money into the crop to expect a boutique or a top shelf price for their commodity when they're done. Is that happening? Yes. Does it happen for everybody? No, but not everybody's version of top shelf is also the same. So farmers have to be aware that there is this potential of grabbing a higher priced value for their product, but it has to meet the market's opinion and standard of what that is.
Okay. Well, all right, James, we have time for one last question for you here. Do you have any other tips for hemp growers looking to develop a nutrition plan for their hemp operation?
Yes. What I would say is budget is key. Understanding your soil, your field, or your footprint is probably the most important part of it all. A farmer, you know, the irony is that some of the best farmers aren't actually the best farmers. They just have the best soil. Some of the best farmers that have the worst soil will never be able to express their potentials they could on a better soil plot, right? In a one acre field, there's going to be a small footprint of that field that's maybe not as good as the rest. Same with a 100-acre field. Farmers need to respect a reasonable average on production. They also need to understand that just because they're harvesting in October doesn't mean they're going to get paid in November. So they need to be prepared, just like every other commodity farmer, to process their material and put it up in a way that it has good storage ability and that they can monetize over the next 3 to maybe even 12 months going into the following season. They also need to not bite off more than they can chew. If it's a new venture for you and you're a farmer used to farming thousands of acres, well, maybe grow 10 or 100. If you're a farmer used to growing on 20 acres, by all means, please do not remove the rest of your crop on the 20 acres and replace it with one you've never done before. Let's have some intelligence about rolling out your production programs and some intelligence and some logic and rationale about how big to really go your first or even second year.
Okay. Thanks for those tips, James, and also for those incredibly detailed answers talking about hemp nutrition, how growers can meet nutrient needs for that crop. We really appreciate having you on today.
appreciate it, Taylor. Thank you very much for having me on. I'll look forward to maybe another visit sometime.
Definitely. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
Thank you again to Taylor. You can hear more of his interviews at myaglife.com. Just click on podcast. And while you're there, check out our new event calendar. This has been the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.